that useful. However, if you could couple water content and acoustics, that could certainly be useful. And you're right, I think I've only seen one group here in the U.S. that have done a lot of acoustic measurements. And there's potential there. So
I'd like to ask the question. Let's use the mic so we can get it.
I think we'll start the panel now.
Pam, you want to come up?
When you're asking questions, use the microphone.
We got four chairs.
If you want to direct
sit on the end.
Quite a number of themes that we've brought forward today in the session. I mean, there's questions of, what was the term you used, blendologist?
Yeah, blendologist,
right,
not garbologist.
If we're going to be blendologists, then do we need more standards and innovation or standards and protocols for mixing? We need more monitoring, like Scott just described. And also, I think there's some communication aspects that Pam brought up about geotechnical engineers and soil scientists. And then that's an important issue because there's a lot of people involved in these soils, and most of them are not soil scientists. And there's all kinds of longevity issues that you brought up. So there's a lot of things to discuss, and I hope that we'll develop some themes here. But let's just go ahead and go with it.
Yeah.
Frank?
Excuse me. Thank you. This was great. Thanks, everybody. I work with Bill in the turf world and with engineered soils, as Bill said, for 50 or some odd years, a lot in the last 20. And the biggest challenges I would say we face now isn't that we don't have numbers. We see our systems evolving to ask questions about microbiomes like every other body's asking. But one of the challenges we face in the real world is the practicality of multi-layered mixes. We can barely get them to do 4 inches of gravel and 12 inches of medium on top and have some spec for that. So I'd like to talk about two things. One is that when we write specifications or consider how things perform, I don't want to say build in a slop factor, but the reality is when you're hauling stuff in and out of New York City or you're hauling stuff in and out of Philadelphia or wherever these things are going to happen, the sheer cost of hauling stuff in and out is staggering. And if they can cut some corners on four levels to hold more water and sand, it simply isn't practical unless they're going to be large layers, like a foot each. Because my experience is the tolerance in the field is 5 or 6 inches to what we think they will actually get the layer in on. You know what I mean? In practicality. So number one, research has to give us some measure of flexibility when Dr. Basta is talking about the various components that we blend in for particular services that it can provide. So I wonder if anyone of you could speak about the challenges of just having to do something that actually has to get done in practice by trucks and bulldozers and people with shovels, where, I don't know, Susan worked a lot in cities with structural soils, getting people and contractors for quality control and assurance and local materials and layers. We've seen a lot of problems with multi-layered mixes because the contractors simply don't do it right.
Who wants to take that question?
I guess I'll use this mic since you can't see me anyway. So since I live in academia, I don't have to deal with the real world too much. So that's that's probably where I haven't, you know, gotten out and experienced this. And I even thought about this multi-layered system, and you're right. I mean, a few centimeters is pretty impractical. What can you do beyond sand? Is somebody going to manufacture a fabric that, you know, geotextile that could be applied in that way? Building a machine that could take a load of sand and then grade it and apply it might be the only practical way to get there, but that's probably a long way out. And ultimately, I guess it comes down to cost. Does a layered system save you money in terms of water, nutrients, and things that you could justify? And that's a big question. I don't know if we're there yet.
I could just talk about something that's totally with the remediation part and the chemical part. I mean, the issue that we get is the stock materials are variable. And so if we're going to make that blend, we got to know what we're starting with. And I see a lot of this issue is testing. So it's kind of like you got a material and you test its ability to absorb something, right? then you know how much to add. But if so, the first part is us getting tests in place so that we could talk about performance and how to blend it, because we're it's hard to get uniform materials. Each now some plants, like water treatment plants, within a water treatment plant, they don't change the process. So a given plant produces the same material each time. But if you're getting it from five different plants, you got to have a test to predict.
With Barangaroo, for example, that was all, most of the stuff was on site. They actually crushed the sandstone that they found. It wasn't delivered anywhere. And the fact that you had no real nutrients in it is because the trees all had no nutrients. And with your water holding capacity, we don't need water either. They just seem to grow. They're just amazing trees. That's how it actually worked. But the person who did this, Simon Lee, also did all the site for the 2000 Olympics, which was also a contaminated site. So and the only problem he had there was to grow a plant that was black, so it painted it.
Right, there's a question over here.
Now, speaking of real world, maybe Nick can address this. Your study in Calumet and the one in Cleveland, I wonder if there is any understanding with the municipality or the local government that, you know, 10 years after your walk, and it looks very good, people won't look at it and think, wow, what could we do with that site? And then you're going to dig it up with an estate or some other thing and dig up everything you buried, everything you think you have. Did you ever think about that? Did you get commitments that the real world, they won't dig it up?
I never get commitments. It's not our site, you know. If they want to dig it up, they can dig it up. I mean, the big thing is it's a demonstration site. And probably once you look at the moonscape, that 25 square miles of like that. You know, it's not a little area. And there used to be five U.S. steel plants there, right? So the best we can do, what I really wanted to do is get on one of the moonscape sites, and the Illinois EPA wouldn't let us on the site that I wanted to get on. But, I mean, that's the best, probably with the tailored blends, I mean, you know how this goes. I mean, the best thing we could do is demonstrations when people come in and they see the growth and they see the performance and everything else. That's what really, you can't see the lead, but that's what really sells them. So I don't think that one study, they'll probably dig it up one day or do something where the bulldozer will show up. But I mean, the idea is to get people to see it and take that approach and extend it to the rest of Calumet. And that's going to take, it'll take a little time. I mean, it's not, we're still pushing there, you know, we're still trying to get them to adopt it.
I'm just wondering that maybe in terms of practicality,
yeah,
it's actually better if the city decides what they want to do, build the houses or whatever they want to do,
right?
And then you come in with final restoration after they've established
what they want. They know what they want to do. Yeah.
There is greed in this.
Yeah.
You know, they see the acreage, they see the moonscape all beautified by what you do. Some politician is going to come in there, some councilman, 15, 20 years later, and they see taxes, what they could do with that land. And everything that you thought you've done and retired, they're going to give you that back up.
Well, there's one thing going for it, though. That's a very swampy area. And so it's really going to be hard for them to put housing residential in that area. That's actually why they went towards ecological restoration. They went to ecological restoration because it's right next to the lake and it's a big flyover area for migratory birds, and it would be difficult for them to develop. And honestly, nobody's moving into Calumet. Okay.
Nick, so I'm going to send you some samples or talk to you about this Bill 3 idea. Rick Seahawk and I have been trying to figure this out in state. The other thing we've been looking at is I've been buying lead paint kits at the hardware stores.
Oh, yeah.
Experimenting with different blends, looking to see how well those respond if this is an indicator of lead presence in the soil. Have you guys heard of anyone trying to develop something like one of those crayon lead test kits for lead that at least will hit the 400 ppm
They're colorimetric, they turn red,
lead. Like even on a window or your barn house, it might look pink.
You know, we haven't, I mean, I'm always leery about how do you lose it in the soil system? You know, because it might work good on a house with paint, but how do you lose it on the soil?
I would use like pH test with a litmus paper or,
It might work. It might work. I mean, you know, I mean, I think honestly that, you know, when we're looking at an inexpensive soil test, it's not that hard. I mean, when it comes down to sampling, I see XRFs before. I've seen the XRFs misused terribly. I mean, because they only penetrate 5 millimeters, and so people are pointing and shooting and finding the lead content in the top 5 millimeters, right? And I think we have to, XRFs are fine, but they're expensive. And, you know, $50,000, I mean, Region 5 wanted to use, that was their approach, XRF. And I said, well, wow, $50,000, I'm growing tomatoes, they're not blackened tomatoes. I mean, and so, and they said, well, we're going to have an office, but you could check out an XRF. I said, really? Well, that didn't happen. So, I mean, but I think honestly, the best we could do is maybe try to figure out how we can get that collection extraction cheap and get it to a lab. The benefit with Malek is we want people to test their soils for nutrients.
Right.
So you just run the lead, and guess what? Like, not only lead, but you get an idea of cadmium, arsenic, and the other contaminants. And also, it's not perfect, you know, you're not throwing darts at a bullseye, but you are hitting the barn with the axes, right? So you will see if you're contaminated or not, and that's a lot of times. So I think the advantage of Malek in getting that test and not using the little kits is there might be something else out there that we can test in the lab.
I'm Dr. Ray Campbell. I came from a soils background and responsible for soil testing, plant analysis. So I respect the things you're saying. This is a very, and let me say that I'm in the field now where the rubber hits the road. And believe it or not, this is a very important topic. And people are out there, including me, building soils, and we're doing things with them. When I say that loosely, I'm referring to anything from turf fields to equestrian areas. There's a lot we don't know, so I would caution everyone, including myself. Sounds like we can mess some areas up in a few years, you know, by doing things like producing and blending biochar with compost, which I'm heavily involved in. The turf people love it. And I would ask the turf grass gentlemen why, what are the issues doing that, if any? And I would even take a step further to people using these humic acid treatments. Are they contributing to some of these layers, or do we even know?
First of all, the biochar, that's interesting. One of our most progressive golf course superintendents in the country, his name is Dan Anelli, he's in Chicago, and he's rebuilding all his greens, complete rebuild, and he's going out on a limb and putting biochar into his greens, and it's a multi-million dollar renovation project on largely an untested thing, right? And so it's definitely a big concern of ours, and we love what he's doing, and we can see the benefits, and he has research plots on his golf course, and he's that kind of a guy. And he's seen the benefit, and so he's all in on the biochar, and again, the testing and the chemical properties, everything is physical properties based now, and we're seeing these iron layers formation. You know, people are putting iron down all the time, and so we can talk about things physically. Then we start putting the chemistry back in there and the biology, and you know, things we can engineer in a lab sound great, and then all of a sudden in 10 years, we're some issues arising that we never would have predicted. And so that's what we're starting to deal with now, and really trying to evaluate, is this construction method the most appropriate or not? So I like what you said, there's a lot that we don't know, and we're trying to kind of understand that more and more, and really trying to link the three different aspects of soils to be a little bit more holistic than just talking about physical properties.
I would just follow up and say that, you know, biochar has some great properties, and it would solve a lot of problems on a golf green from toxicities or whatever. So just think about it. I've seen it put on golf course greens and turn it green within a
We get the same results. We have to charge it usually with some kind of fertilizer solution, and then you mix it in with the sand. That's what Dan is going to be doing. So it'll be interesting to see what's going on there. And so we're going to work with him to kind of document those changes. And he also got a bunch of the biochar he's planning on using to test them with our XRF stand that we showed last night with our clay and iron layer formation research. So.
We have another question here.
Yeah, one for Beal and one for me. That's the home.
Can you turn it off? Yeah, speaker to it.
The layering, of course, that has a heterogenetic processes that you can't run away from. And, of course, the perch layer will almost define the point that you will have in anoxic zone, whether you have your iron dissolution on top of this aerated gravel, and that in the interface you will see this iron precipitation. So, does any of research is put into try to make this transition more mild to the point that you won't have this saturated layer sitting on top of the aerated? Or maybe on a practical purpose, prescribe some leaching fraction or excess of leaching fraction with irrigation to eliminate some of the bicarbonate or the iron precipitation that you mentioned. And of course, as for the depth of that, if I recall correctly, and it was quite a while ago, USGA specs are based on what Scott was showing with the water retention curve to make sure that you don't have the whole profile in the saturation zone rather than, so if you have the zero potential at that bottom of the 30 centimeter, you can then easily manufacture the profile of size-wise to manage based on the texture of your mix, what is the air-water ratio that you get there. For Nick, and I guess, and I think a few years ago I saw
So I'm not sure exactly where we are with time.
Okay,
2 minutes. Right. So that first question
right
is your last.
Okay. With respect to the depth of the water table and the perch water table, I can understand that they did initially do computer modeling to figure, you know, the appropriate depth of root zone, but when you do some even rough calculations and we actually measure depth, you know, water content volumetrically through depth, we see, especially when organic matter starts in, it's all great at first, but then organic matter starts to accumulate, and then that distribution just starts to decay away. And so it's one of the issues that we have, where we have a lot of moisture on the surface. It's pretty void of moisture, maybe 5-6%, and then you have 10% moisture at the interface, 12% moisture at the interface. And it's pretty small. I mean, it really is a centimeter of higher enriched subsoil moisture content. But the layers, you know, we're trying to look at ways. I mean, we don't see this across every green, so it's not just just the redox potential and the EH boundary. There's something else going on there. We think pH is really important, looking at a Forbay diagram and trying to understand how EH, pH are working together to determine the speciation of the iron. And so that's a big part of it. Interestingly, the first USGA profiles had a choker layer of coarse sand between the sand in the root zone and the gravel, and we haven't seen this yet in those type of constructions. So there's a more diffuse border instead of the more stark border that we have now with the root zone and the gravel. So that might also be intensifying the more recent development of these iron and manganese layers.
So we are out of time. I'm thrilled that there's so many questions that we can't answer, but I'm sorry for those of you that don't have an opportunity to ask. But if the speakers can hang around, perhaps you can have some more interaction. But let me just ask if we can once again show our appreciation for the speakers.